There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast. Monday, 9th of March today, a tumultuous day on the markets. These are the highlights from today's show. Markets this morning in Asia reopening. I thought it would be bad, Brandy. I didn't think it would be quite this dramatic, particularly when it comes to oil.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me give you the latest prices this morning before we head from Ed Bell from Emirates NBD, commodity expert there. WTI, still under $29 a barrel, $28.93. Brent crude has ticked up a little bit, but I'm not saying it's good news. $32.79 is where we are at the minute.
Well, you mentioned Ed Bell there, Senior Director of Market Economics at Emirates NBD. Obviously watching this one very, very closely. We asked him, what's the story?
Oil markets are in a complete free fall in early trading today. Brent price is down as much as 25% in early trading as the market comes to grips with the breakdown of the Saudi-Russia oil production pact and the pending price war that's going to develop between the two producers. Now, if we consider that at this time last week, the market was pricing in at least 1 million barrel a day cut in production, the failure to get a deal, and actually the impact of increased production is an astonishing reversal and a real failure of oil market policy and oil market diplomacy on the part of these producers. So at this point, we expect to see the core OPEC countries like Saudi Arabia, UAE, Iraq, Kuwait engage in a market share strategy. So they're going to be increasing production, and Saudi Arabia is reportedly already planning to increase crude to as much as 11 million barrels a day in April, up from less than 10 million barrels a day currently. So we're going to see an enormous dump of crude oil onto markets in the second quarter that's really going to overwhelm demand that's being corroded by the outbreak of the coronavirus in major economies. Now, with that deluge coming, prices are taking a beating and adjusting to new lower levels. We recently lowered our oil price views for 2020 to an average of $45 for Brent, and that did incorporate prices falling to around current levels in Q2.
Also been speaking to Sean Evers, founder of managing partner of Gulf Intelligence. It's a consultancy focused mainly, not exclusively, on the energy industry. And you asked him, Brandy, to kind of take a step back and say, well, what went wrong in Vienna, didn't you?
Absolutely. Let's put some context around the falls that we are seeing this morning. What happened over the weekend to lead to this?
Well, A little bit of a quick history. 3-4 years ago, 2015-16, the oil price collapsed because there was a fight for market share. All countries pumped what they could in order to capture market share, and the price collapsed. And out of that came a joint venture between OPEC and non-OPEC, Russia and Saudi Arabia, essentially. And together over 3 years, they very cooperatively rebuilt the oil markets, removed the excess inventories, and propped up prices, which stabilized all in all in and around the $60 to $70 range. Everybody's happy. In the last few weeks, months, the price, the supply demands have gone out of sync again, and they required OPEC and non-OPEC, Russia and Saudi Arabia, to come together again to find a new agreement to cut even more oil to ensure oil prices stayed up around 60. And Russia simply said, no, I'm not doing anymore. And Saudi took that as a divorce notice and basically has decided to pump as much as it can.
We also looked at the demand side of this story because, of course, this is happening at a very interesting, and I use that word as a euphemism, time where you've not only got this fallout in OPEC and increase in supply, but you have also got reduced demand globally and, well, mainly in China. Sean Evers has been giving us context.
Well, this is the real unique moment we're in, and we're caught, in essence, in the middle of it, to be honest. You have the perfect storm of demand collapse in China, the world's biggest oil importer, through the course of, as we all know, February, now into March, of the coronavirus, the economic collapse, or not collapse of China, but ultimately the industrial production in China just stopped for a month. And with that, you probably took close to 3 million barrels of oil a day off the market in demand for at least a month, maybe 2 months. So you've got a real weak demand outlook. Of course, the rest of the world now struggling with the corona economic impact. And with all of that, energy demand decline. So very softening and very fast softening oil demand. And then at the same time, you're accelerating supply. I mean, if you did that with any product in any market, there's only one outcome. The price collapses until you find balance again. And balance is where supply and demand match.
So one of the things we asked him was, can they patch things up again? Because if you remember, it just seems like a long time ago now, Friday, at the OPEC meeting in Vienna, Mohamed Barkindo is the Secretary General. And he was asked by reporters, well, what's going to happen now? We've had this, if you like, I don't know, difference of opinions, should we call it, euphemistically, between Saudi Arabia and Russia on what to do. Can they patch things up? And this is what Mohamed Barkindo told reporters.
I am a born optimist. I believe that nobody in this group of countries would like us to relapse into the last downturn that we went through 2014, 2015, 2016. They're all conscious of that.
Well, we have lapsed into precisely that kind of downturn. So the question to Sean was, can they patch things up?
I mean, I think ultimately you would think the answer is yes, unless there are other agendas at play here. And these are very unique, counterintuitive times, one might say. Of course, you have the backdrop of the coronavirus. I mean, Northern Italy is in quarantine. I mean, it's pretty crazy stuff going on in the world at the moment. But Russia may have alternative agendas here that aren't simply the supply demand, the agreement with OPEC, non-OPEC. It seems to me if it was just that, they could find an answer to this problem. It seems that perhaps Russia sees this, others may see this as an opportunity to send messages in other directions, let's say, that are beyond OPEC's remit. And when you're in the big high sky of geopolitics, there isn't any real OPEC country that surfs that high in the sky. This is real big time stuff. And when you're up there, you kind of are a bystander.
So challenges, no question, but we've also been looking, Brandy, today, haven't we, at companies that are seeing an uptick in business, and there are quite a few. It wasn't that hard to find them, to be honest, was it? We don't have to look very far.
No, not at all. We've been speaking this morning to digital companies, online companies, about the uptick in their businesses. We're going to hear from one in detail in about 10 minutes. That's Patrick Shaloub, CEO of Shaloub Group, major luxury retailer here in the UAE. But we've also been speaking to online retailers in specific sectors, including, weirdly, laundry, but also mums, kids, dads, family type stuff, everything from strollers to nappies. Sarah Jones is the founder and the CEO of Spree.com, and we asked her, what have you seen in terms of activity in the past few weeks?
It's been really, really interesting. It's been a gradual increase in sales, in comparison to what we would normally expect. But very, very focused on, certain categories. We're up about 30, 40% at the moment in comparison to where we would, have expected to be. So definitely a kind of silver lining there for, I think, e-commerce businesses, and especially those like, Spree selling mums and kids products. So yeah, diapers, specifically, as well as baby formula and obviously sanitizing, anything that's kind of linked to the sanitizing category have, had a huge jump up.
We've also been speaking to Rami Shah, CEO and co-founder of the UAE-based laundry and dry cleaning app Washman, to ask him the same question. What have you seen recently?
Over the last few weeks, we've experienced a significant jump in volumes. And this growth is broken down not just by, the higher number of orders, but actually the basket size per customer has increased. On average, our number of items per basket has increased from 6 items to about 8. And this is quite a significant jump from our norms as a business. So we've also seen that this growth is not just coming from existing customers, but from new customers that are opting into home deliveries as opposed to going to community centers and sending their clothes, whether it's a mall or the local laundry shop. We're seeing just a trend towards opting into delivery services as opposed to interacting with people outside of their homes.
That's Remy Shah, CEO and co-founder of the laundry company Washman.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's talk business now with one of the giants, one of the titans of the regional retail industry. Delighted to be welcomed in the Dubai Eye studio by the chief executive of the Shaloub Group, Patrick Shaloub. Morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Richard.
It's nice to see you. Listen, it's a fairly gloomy day to have you here in the studio, but Shaloub Group was established back in 1955. This is not your first rodeo. You've seen downturns before. How do you react as a luxury retailer with brands like Louis Vuitton, Dior, and others at a time like this?
I mean, we try to stay normal. I was hearing you a little bit earlier, Richard and Brandy, and I felt that everything is going bad. We are alive, we are in a good health, we have to live in our normality, we have to keep as normal as we are with the up and downs of life. So we try to give this message of security and of normality to our clients, to our people within the organization, and to go through it in the most normal way.
And how do the lessons of history help you do that? Your family founded this company more than half a century ago. You've lived through the 1991 Gulf War. You've lived through the 2008 financial crisis and other downturns. How does that help you, Patrick?
I mean, every time you have to learn of what's happening, you never know how long it lasts and how deep it is. And you have to go through it and then get all the learnings in order to prepare yourself for a brighter tomorrow and be totally ready and take those learnings in order to move ahead and continue. So what's important in life? What's important for us? And how can we just continue living and then from it get better at the time where things settle down? So today everybody is so worried. But again, we have all to make sure that there is all the necessary measure taken in terms of health. We have to contend the crisis as much as we can.
How much can you, though, deal with things like this from a price point of view? I mean, one of the things about the luxury market is that discounting is often frowned on by a lot of brands. They don't like to see their goods on sale. So what flexibility do you have there to keep customers?
I mean, the flexibility is to be able to offer them a fantastic service, to offer them a human touch, to offer them reassuring messages, to offer them experiences and things which they could live into it. I mean, this question of every time playing on prices in order to be able to attract is not the reality. The price which we give is a price which is deserved to be paid, but we have to give everything which is around it, and today more than ever.
So if we look at some of the wider trends happening in your industry, the coronavirus outbreak is a very clear and present incident. But actually, you've been talking about a new normal in retail for several years now, and you've been digitally transforming your business. I think 2014 was when you started your digital transformation strategy because you recognized that there was a shift happening. Give us a progress update on that. How different does Shaloub Group look today in 2020 than back in 2014 when you began this digital journey?
We were late to engage. In fact, we engaged in 2015, not 2014. And we were late to understand that, in fact, it is not only a new norm, but that we all are being transformed from physical to digital, and we have to encompass physical and digital in our life. There is no more, for me, two words, a digital world, an e-commerce world, a brick and mortar world. There is only one world where all of us are influenced by what's happening in real life, what's happening through our digital devices, could transact digitally, could transact physically. And I think that we have to have this global view of a customer, be it digital or be it physical. And so as a group, we have made quite a lot in order to be able to understand what the customer really wants, to be present at each one of his touch points, digital or physical, to promote or to sell, in order to make sure that we use the best of the technology to be convenient for our customer, to use the less of the technology to be absolutely transparent with our customer. You were speaking about prices. Today, it's a glass house, so we have to be absolutely transparent. to make everything which we can to delight our customers, but also to keep this desirability of our brands to the customer through our physical interconnection and human interconnection, or through our digital devices and the way the customer wants.
What percentage this year do you think of your revenue as Chalhoub Group will be from digital? From, I guess, zero in 2014, what percentage would it be this year?
As a group, we have been late to engage. Today, we are probably at 4% of our business, which is digital, in a market where we feel, at least into the luxury, into the Middle East, it's probably at 6 or 6.5%. Today, we are at 4% as a group, but at the same time, we have been quite selective into where and what we want to sell, because we want to make sure that our brands are keeping the exclusivity and the desirability they look for. But at the same time, it's growing very much. So at the same time, our level of growth in digital is about 30% year on year, while the rest of the activity is quite flat in general.
Let's dig into one of our headlines this morning, and that is the rise in online activity on the back of the coronavirus. What have you seen in your online business over the last 3 weeks, 4 weeks at Chalhoub?
The trend has been similar to what has happened in other countries which have been affected. People are staying more at home, are using more their digital devices and buying more online. So we have seen a big surge in our activity into the e-com, double the rate of growth which we have had up till now, and keep on growing because it's convenient for people today to stay at home and they are worried to go in public places, and therefore there is this rise, which is really developing the e-com. And thanks God, we have our 8 sites and we have 2 more sites which will be coming online very soon. So,
what are you doing to make sure that you can cope with that faster growth, or indeed to capitalize on it? Are you bringing some of those new sites to market earlier? Are you ramping up at all?
I mean, we have had a very aggressive program to ramp up all our sites, but it's true that we are trying now to accelerate everything. But the most important is to give, not to disappoint our customer. Once again, is to delight him, even if it is through our e-com sites, and to make sure that we give substance, that we deliver on time, that we keep the communication going, and we take this opportunity to connect with the customer. And if we cannot connect by him visiting us, we can connect over the phone, we can connect over the mails, and we try to keep the conversation going with our customer. The most important is to maintain our human touch, even if some of the clients prefer not to visit the stores.
Because it has to be said, I mean, the analysis on the luxury industry at the moment makes for pretty grim reading. Luxury retailers around the world concerned about what the lack of Chinese visitors, Chinese buyers means for luxury brands in Europe, in the US. What's the case here? How important is the Chinese buyer?
To put things in perspective, Brandy, Chinese represent 30 to 40% of the sales of luxury worldwide. In Dubai, which is the place where we are seeing more of the rise of this Chinese tourism, it would represent between 6 and 10% of the sales of luxury brands and luxury products. The trend of Chinese coming and buying their luxury stuff in Dubai is perhaps happening, but slowly. So we were less affected by the fact of not having Chinese tourists since now over a month.
So we know that the bigger picture trend is that you are creating a digital platform. It's 4% of your business now, but it's fast growing. You say you've got 8 different brands and platforms. I'm really interested to know the conversations you've had about which brands you put online. Do you put Chalhoub.com? I guess not, because people don't really know that brand. We know Louis Vuitton. We know Dior. We also know some of your homegrown brands. Level Shoes, for example, in Dubai Mall is one of your brands. Triano, the department store in Yas Mall, is one of your brands. What's the sweet spot for the number of brands online? Not one, but then not 20 either.
I mean, as a group, we have taken the decision not to open our own platform. So we supply a lot of those marketplaces and platform, and we supply them as we would supply department stores. What we have done is mainly to open sites for each one of the brands. So for us, it's really this hybrid navigation with the customer. We have opened sites for, our target is to open sites for as many brands as we have. So we have a site for level.com, we have Traiano.com, we have other sites, Swarovski.com, which we operate, or Lacoste.com, or some of the other sites. And for us, it's really the customer, whatever he wants, wherever he wants. So his access point could be through the site of the brands. And once we are in connection with him, we maintain the discussion, we maintain the dialogue. And if he comes to the store, we invite him to come to the site. If he comes to the site, we invite him to come to the store. And every time we have to make sure that we are present every place where the customer is.
How do you make sure that if I go to, for example, Louis Vuitton in one of the malls here or in Saudi Arabia, and they're beautiful stores, they're huge and they're beautifully fitted out, I dread to think what they must cost you, an absolute fortune. But if I go and try on a pair of Louis Vuitton
loafers,
for example, and then buy them online, how do you make sure that I spend the money with you? Or can you not make sure that I then spend the money with you digitally?
I mean, we are never sure that you will spend the money with us. Even if you go to a mall, you can go from a store to a store. If you go, you could open, you can go to a department store, or you can come to our stores. So the most important for us is how are we going to attract the customer, and we are going to attract him by giving him a fantastic service, by giving him experiences, by having this connection with him. How are we going to retain him? How are we going to maintain this dialogue and give him things which he is looking for, and making sure to give this attraction, but keeping also this human connection in him? Nothing is guaranteed forever anymore. So we really need to make sure that we are better in what we are doing in order to delight our customers and then to get his loyalty and be loyal to him.
Patrick, as ever, it's an absolute pleasure talking to you. We could chat for hours, but we'll have to leave it there. Patrick Shaloub is the Chief Executive Officer of the Shaloub Group, one of the largest, if not the largest, luxury retailers here in the Gulf. And we really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Brandy.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. The Business Breakfast's Pick of the Papers.
News editor Natasha Thomas with us in the studio from the ARN News Centre. Morning, Natasha.
Good morning, Richard.
Now, a story you're following very closely is related to COVID-19 and in particular, Saudi Arabia.
Yes, so we've just heard from Saudi Arabia, who've suspended operations from 9 countries, including the UAE, Kuwait and Bahrain, in an effort to control the spread of coronavirus. So there was a tweet from Saudi Arabia's state news agency, SBA. It confirmed that all flights and naval trips between the kingdom and the UAE, Kuwait, Bahrain, Lebanon, Syria, South Korea, Egypt, Italy and Iraq will be temporarily halted. It has also suspended travel to these countries for its citizens and residents and restricted the entry of people from those countries or anyone who has been there in the past 14 days. Now, what's happening in Saudi Arabia at the moment is there have been 4 new cases of COVID-19 detected. It takes the total number to 15. Schools in the kingdom have been shut down from today until further notice. So these are just part of the precautionary measures they've taken to help stop the spread of the virus. Now, we at the news centre, we've been looking at how this affects airlines locally. So in a statement issued on its website, Etihad Airways said this affects all their flights between Abu Dhabi and Jeddah, Riyadh, Medina and Dammam. Etihad is working with impacted guests to rebook or refund their tickets. Emirates Airline has also confirmed that all flights to Dammam, Jeddah, Medina and Riyadh have been suspended today, tomorrow and the day after. They say operations to Medina have been cancelled up to and including March the 12th. And again, affected passengers can contact their travel agent or Emirates to rebook until June 30th. We've also reached out to Fly Dubai and Air Arabia to find out which flights have been affected by this.
I mean, it's the dominant story on the ARN News Centre news app, Natasha. But it's not the only story. Hmm. You've got, for example, relatively good news, no coronavirus cases among Emirati students. You've got the story from DIFC that we're covering about a record number of companies down there. You've also got the story that I know Brandy's been looking at today, which is about the property market here in Dubai. And it's not gangbusters, the property market, but there's the signs that we may be close to the bottom and perhaps even some kind of recovery in the Dubai property market. This was Property Monitor, wasn't it? And some research that they came out with, the Property Monitor Index, I think it was, Brandy.
Absolutely. Well, look, they do this every month. The Property Monitor Dynamic Price Index, say that three times really quickly, or the DPI, as it's known, basically looks at 40-odd areas of Dubai and has a look at what's happening with price by square foot. The bad news is that, it depends which side of the equation you're on. The absolutely fantastic news, if you are someone on the Property Finder website like myself at the moment looking at potentially getting into the property market, the brilliant news is that prices in February are at their lowest level in 88 months. Good news for me on this side of the desk. Slightly less good news for Richard Dean on the other side of the desk, who is a property owner. But just remember, on every trade, there is someone on both sides of it. So we've got the lowest level in 88 months. And for the month February from January, we have a drop of around 0.5, so about half of 1 percentage point. However, that the actual decline itself is steadying somewhat, and the transactions, unsurprising given the lower prices, the volume of sales transactions is going gangbusters. We are seeing an increase of 43% in transactions up from January, and the feedback from the brokers that the Property Monitor guys are getting is that even the stuff that's, you know, hasn't yet translated into a sale, offers, that sort of thing, has also increased dramatically in the first 2 months of the year. So this is the sort of thing, if you're looking at getting into the market, plus we've got lower interest rates as well, it might all be coming together for you right now. If you are a property owner, well, your property is not worth a specific value until you actually go to sell it. So how much your square foot is worth whilst your toddlers are playing on it is almost immaterial. But if you are selling at the moment, possibly not the best time for you.
I've found you some lovely penthouses.
What do you think, Natasha? Are we moving? Are we buying?
Yeah, definitely. Well, Natasha has a husband and two small children. She'd probably reluctant to leave me. I don't know, maybe not reluctant to leave
me. I didn't mean are we buying, although I can see this bachelorette pad. This is brilliant.
You can be your weekend retreat, Natasha.
Let's discuss this off air.
Let's get a fancy fridge.
Smeg. UAE flag one.
That's what I'm thinking. Smeg, either mint or pink. What do you reckon?
Get an India flag one and then she'll be in.
Yeah, totally. Some high-end appliances, a good coffee maker. Your family won't see you again.
What else are we covering at the moment? I'll tell you what I'm looking at, Natasha. I know you've been looking at this as well. It's a story out of India. Overnight, we've learned that Rana Kapoor is behind bars. Now, he's the co-founder and managing director of Yes Bank in India. And for years and years and years, he's been one of the heroes of the Indian business community. He was a successful banker for many years with Bank of America and other big banks. And then he set up his own bank, Yes Bank, 10, 15 years ago, was it? And it was a success story. But it has hit the skids lately, and he has been arrested on money laundering charges. He says he's done nothing wrong. He's just been made a scapegoat because the bank has run into difficulties over bad loans, as many financial institutions in India have.
Yeah.
But the authorities say, no, this is more than just a few loans turning bad. There's more to it than that. What can you tell us about Rana Kapoor and this story?
The accusation against Rana Kapoor is that it was his style of functioning that led to the demise of Yes Bank. As you've just said, you know, the bank couldn't service its debts, but there was mainly because of defaults by big companies to whom it had loaned large amounts. Now, obviously, this has to come from the top. There has to be some sort of approval process in place. And usually the person who approves these kind of loans is the man in charge, which is what the RBI is saying. They said, you know, it was his style of functioning. What he did was wrong. So the Reserve Bank of India has now taken control of the private lender, and they're saying they will work on a revival plan. So I have been, you know, following this story, and what's interesting is there have been a lot of accusations flung on either side of the fence. So the current government, the finance minister, Nirmala Sitharam, has accused former finance minister P. Chidambaram, saying, you know, it was his policies, the
Peter Dambrin was like 6 years ago in the Congress government, wasn't he?
So this, so what she was trying to say was whatever happened pre 2014 has led to what's happening now.
Okay.
So there is, but if you actually look at the numbers, if you crunch the numbers, the loan portfolio of Yes Bank actually increased by 434% under the current government, and that's what. The RBI has found out. Those are the stats which have come out. And, you know, some of the big defaulters have been the likes of Anil Ambani, the brother of Mukesh Ambani. He's had a lot of issues with his companies. Then Subhash Chandra Goyal, who is the owner of SL Group, the founder of Zee News. So, you know, companies like that, when they default on loans, it really affects your bottom line if you're the likes of Yes Bank.
Natasha Thomas, thank you very much. Indeed, it's a busy day for you. We'll let you get back to the ARN News Centre right now.
Thank you.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Business continues and some businesses are seeing an uptick, including e-commerce and the delivery business. Joining us in the studio to tell us more about this, the Chief Executive Officer of Talabat Food Delivery and more than that, delivery platform, Tommaso Rodriguez. Tommaso, good morning. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us what's been happening to your business, your core food delivery business, first of all, over the past couple of weeks.
So I think the most important thing when it comes to food delivery is that we've been on top of this since a while, I would say, when it comes to coronavirus. So the most important thing for us is really about safety. And when I talk about safety, I mean like rider safety, customer safety, and our partner restaurant safety. We're working with all the local authorities to ensure the maximum hygiene and healthy standards across the board. So that's our number one priority. The good thing is that, you know, being part of a global group as of Delivery Hero, we've been observing some trends in Asia as well before, you know, the news hit our market, and we were well prepared. In Asia, we've been seeing a big spike in orders and growth, and that's starting to happen here as well. So I think I want to reiterate that really safety is the most important thing right now. And we're making sure this happens.
So in terms of there has been an uptick in demand in general terms. Let's drill down a little bit more into the Talabat business here. Yeah. So Talabat we think of as a food delivery platform, although you're more than that. You're groceries as well, aren't you?
Yes.
But what in particular are you seeing demand for? Is there a particular time of day? Is there a particular type of product or price point that you're seeing an increase in?
Yeah, so I think we launched our grocery, our own grocery stores. It's called Talabat Daily, just a couple of weeks ago in Dubai and in September in Kuwait. We now cover 100%, 80% of Kuwait, and we see a drastic spike since we started. In Kuwait, we're doing already 5,500 orders a day on Talabat Daily. And Dubai just started. We have two locations and opening more very soon. I think we have a partnership with Unilever as well right now to provide Lifebuoy sanitizers and items like that. But I would say a completely unrelated item that we're selling a lot and still didn't figure out why is on breakfast, Red Bull and bananas. I think it's the is the breakfast of the champions. I don't really know why, but that seems to sell a lot.
I don't know how to follow that one up.
What about the delivery orders though? Food delivery. If we take the last 4 weeks, what kind of percentage jump have you seen there? How much busier are you?
I think it's not entirely about numbers. We didn't see a massive spike in the last couple of weeks, I would say. And we've been working a lot on training our riders, on making up new practices, sending them videos, for example, on how to deliver to customers, just how not to handle the bag with the hands, you know, drop in safe zones, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we on purpose also delayed a bit our operations, right, to ensure maximum safety standards. And that's really been the focus.
So are we not actually ordering more? Because it's easy to think, okay, if people aren't as keen maybe on going out for a bit, or you've got three kids at home suddenly that you are juggling, you know, the online schooling, the platform, the early holidays with, that we might be. But are we not? Are we not ordering more takeaway food, delivery food than we were 2 months ago?
No, yeah. No, in the last 2 months, the business, don't get me wrong, it's been growing massively, you know, double-digit percentage across all the markets. We also understand that this is a difficult situation for the customers, right? And a difficult situation for the restaurants as well, because the restaurants are facing big problems in dine-in, right? The dine-in business is suffering a lot from the situation. So what we've been doing lately is we've been providing a lot of free delivery options across the region. In every given location, if you open the app today, from Media City, for example, here in Dubai, you're going to find around 80 free delivery restaurants around you. Talabat is absorbing the cost of this this free delivery because we want to help our restaurant partners go through this difficult situation, and our customers that are stuck at home to be able to buy and save some money.
Is that a long game for you? Do you know if you treat your restaurant partners well now, you help them stay in business, that 2, 3, 4 years' time you'll still have those partners?
Well, it's always a long game, but in the sense that we are partnering this together, right? So at the end of the day, if the partners are happy, we are happy, and we need to help them grow as if they grow, we grow, right? So it's always important that all the objectives are aligned.
A final word, if we take a step back from the current situation, the dynamics in the food delivery business, you're familiar with them. You used to be a very senior guy at Uber and Uber Eats. Before joining Talabat, the unit economics of food delivery, lots has been written about the fact that it's unsustainable, that the likes of you and Deliveroo and Uber Eats and other players in this market are effectively subsidizing customers like me at the moment in this land grab for customers, but in the medium to long term, that's not sustainable. What you're owned by a German parent company, for example, Talabat. How do you see the unit economics of food delivery in the Middle East in 2020? Can you break even? Can you make a profit in this region?
Well, Talabat is profitable since many years already, actually. It's been one of the very first food delivery companies in the world breaking even. We're a 16-year-old company, a real success story from the GCC. And I think we really proved that this, things are wrong. So we've been profitable since a while now.
I'm happy for you. Busy time for you. We'll let you guys get back to the office. Tomaso Rodriguez is the Chief Executive Officer of Talabat. Really appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.